When I read that Andrew Lloyd Webber had set Eliot's Practical Cats to music, I felt vindicated at last. I literally laughed out loud with satisfaction. And the best part is that the show became a tremendous hit. Way back in olden times, when I was in college, an English professor suggested to our class that we purchase a collection of T.S. Eliot's work. I bought the book and discovered, among other things, Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. One day I mentioned to the professor how much I liked Eliot's cat poems. The professor stared at me with sort of a benign contempt and said, "Of course, you know, those are not real poetry." Of course. But as I studied Eliot's serious work and that of other 20th century poets, it always seemed important to me that Eliot had also written about Bustopher Jones and the old Gumby cat. And it seemed exactly right that the Practical Cats should have emerged in the 1980s as a hit musical. Poets always see their world and their times with a vision that their less observant contemporaries lack. They often see the connections between disparate events or the overall trends of the culture long before others are aware of them. Or at the very least, poets often gather up the experiences, the fears, or the hopes of a generation and give them expression. Eliot, writing in the 1920s and 1930s, described the breakdown of all the old securities and beliefs. He saw people struggling to find meaning in a wasteland of broken images. He wrote, "What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images, where the sun beats and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Unreal city, under the brown fog of a winter dawn, a crowd flowed over London Bridge, so many, I had not thought death had undone so many. Sighs, short and infrequent, were exhaled, and each man fixed his eyes before his feet. What is that sound high in the air, murmur of maternal lamentation? Who are those hooded hordes swarming over endless plains, stumbling in cracked earth, ringed by the flat horizon only? What is the city over the mountains, cracks and reforms and bursts in the violet air? Falling towers, Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London, unreal." And indeed, the towers did fall literally as well as intellectually. 40 years later, the theologians caught up with the poet. "God is dead," they pronounced. "God and the entire old order of things has been crumbling ever since." In desperation, its leaders, our leaders, cling to their weapons, their outworn ideologies, afraid to let go of the old images, broken though they are, because the new ones are still uncertain and unclear. Something similar happens very often in our personal lives as well. Take marriages, for example. Sometimes we cling to an image of how the relationship should be, pretending to be happy when in reality we're afraid to look at the changes that have occurred. Distance develops as we speak only of superficial matters and not about how we really feel. Sometimes we don't know what our real feelings are. Once upon a time, I was in a marriage, something like that. When I tried to break through the distance that separated us, my husband would become annoyed. One day, in a fit of consternation, he blurted out, "You are absolutely incapable of getting into any kind of a rut." I consider that to be a profound compliment. But how does it happen? How do we get so cut off, so distant, so caught up in obligations rather than in the joy of living? Well, I believe there are at least two attitudes or ways of looking at life that contribute to this state of affairs. The first is living in terms of other people's expectations. See, I was a good girl. I did well in school. I married a nice young engineer, had two children, and took care of a cute little house in the suburbs. I had everything a young woman was supposed to want. And why wasn't I happy? Well, I never thought to ask what I wanted or needed, only what I was expected by others to do. I buried my needs, and I was angry, but I didn't know why, so I tried not to show it. I became distant. I married someone distant. We couldn't afford closeness because it might unleash the buried anger and the unmet needs. The second attitude that contributes to our alienation from each other is living in the future. My in-laws scrimped and saved and denied themselves all their lives so that when they retired, they would have the money to fulfill two big dreams, to design and build their own beautiful home and to take a trip to Europe. When they retired, they did build a beautiful home in the mountains. They lived in it less than a year when he fell ill and died. The home was too large and expensive for her to maintain, so she sold it. And they never did take the trip to Europe. I thought it was the saddest possible way to live, and I said, not me. I'm going to enjoy life. But not too many years later, I heard myself saying to my children, we'll have more time together after I get my degree. We'll take a vacation when I get a better job, when I have more money. And there I was, living my life in the future, too, letting the present slip by unnoticed and unenjoyed. Rick Maston's song about Robert and Nancy says it well. Robert, buried in the Tribune with his coffee, reading all about the day before. Nancy, just across the table with her teacup, she studies what the tea leaves hold in store. And the now, the moment, slips away, gone with its joy and sorrow. He was here yesterday, and she's coming tomorrow. When we live out a stereotype, meeting other people's expectations, we shrink ourselves and ignore our own human needs. We cannot be open to the present lest our needs and our anger show. We feel distant, trapped, and life passes us by. When we live in the future instead of the present, we lose contact not only with other people, but with nature as well. We have no time for flowers or sunsets in our drive toward the future. We can also ignore pollution. We wind up with neither people nor nature to sustain us. What are we afraid of in the present and in ourselves? One time in New Jersey, the minister of the fellowship I belonged to called me early one Friday morning before I left for work. Shirley, he asked, can you speak Sunday morning for 1 minute on psychological truth? You want psychological truth in 1 minute, I said. Sure. He invited a poet, a scientist, a painter, a musician, and me, a psychologist, to speak on our particular brands of truth. When we got together on Saturday to share what we planned to say, we were struck by the fact that we all mentioned a moment of terror, of profound anxiety. The artist facing a blank canvas, the individual in therapy having to let go of an old self in order to face what she might become, the scientist proposing a new hypothesis. All face that moment of terror. I believe there are moments in all of our lives, when we must break with the shattered images and worn-out ethics of the past and put forth our own perceptions of the world, our own true thoughts and feelings and actions, moments when we risk the anger of our families or the strictures of our society in order to be our authentic, healthy selves. At such moments, we may feel we are on a cold journey in the dark, all alone. It's no wonder we often squelch our real selves rather than risk the loss of relationship, social ostracism, or in some cases, even violence. See, he's living in the present. For most people today, God is dead, heaven is an illusion, and hell is here and now. T.S. Eliot labeled the situation well when he called it the wasteland. It is indeed terrifying to live in a wasteland where all the old securities have become a heap of broken images. In Eliot's time and for many years thereafter, it was fashionable to assume that we were helpless victims of forces beyond our control. Individually, we were envisioned as driven by unconscious impulses, and socially, we felt at the mercy of political and economic powers. There appeared to be nothing we could do to extricate ourselves from the wasteland of modern life. Well, the practical cats always knew who they were, what they wanted, and what was important. Part of their appeal lies in the very fact that we know cats refuse our anthropomorphic projections. They simply go about the serious and hilarious business of being cats. For a long time now, we humans have not known who we are. A popular song a few years back put it succinctly, "We didn't know who we were just on the road." And even earlier, the Beatles sang about the nowhere man who doesn't have a point of view and knows not where he's going to. Today, I think we have something more. Poets and artists have long been pointing the way toward a new image for humanity. Eliot understood that whatever that new worldview might be, it would at least in part be a reclaiming of our origins, our source, our beginnings. He writes in Little Gidding, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." Today we have it spelled out for us by psychologists who implore us to elevate trust, nurturance, and relationship to a place of greater importance than distrust, conquest, and alienation. And by ecologists who beg us to halt our exploitation of the earth, to return to an understanding of nature as sacred. Return, they say, to those human qualities we have neglected and to that connectedness with nature that we have all but lost. Out of the gradual death of the old order has come the terrifying but exhilarating knowledge that we cannot leave our fate or that of the earth to God or anyone else. We know it is up to us, and we know that together we have the power to change directions. If hell is here and now, so is heaven. The moment of fearful truth is also the moment of possibility. We still have what religious people have always had, ourselves and the natural world. Wallace Stevens says it well in a poem called Sunday Morning. He writes, "Why should she give her bounty to the dead? What is divinity if it can come only in silent shadows and in dreams? Shall she not find in comforts of the sun, in pungent fruit and bright green wings, or else in any balm or beauty of the earth, things to be cherished like the thought of heaven? Divinity must live within herself. Passions of rain or moods in falling snow, grievings in loneliness, or unsubdued elations when the forest blooms, gusty emotions, on wet roads, on autumn nights, all pleasures and all pains, remembering the vow of summer and the winter branch. These are the measures destined for her soul. The creator of Peanuts said it another way. Please join me in using the cartoon sequence and the insert in your program as a responsive reading. People over here, read Lucy's part. People over here, read Charlie Brown's part. Okay, Charlie.